You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the meeting grounds for spirituality and society, religion and culture.
After the candle sharing this morning, I thought my topic seems to be fairly apt, thinking through troubled times. When I was in my 20s, I used to think how much luckier I was than my parents, who were born during the Depression and lived through World War II and Korea. Mum had to resign when she married. They raised children in the pre-pill 50s, and we lived in remote regions of South Australia. Money was tight and they had little to spend upon themselves until they were really old, in their 50s. Now I'm even older. I look back and see my cohort's fortunes as rather more grey and gloomy than I had hitherto imagined. In my teens, we had the Vietnam War, the killing fields of Cambodia, which of course John read about, and later the invasion of East Timor. Greed is good 80s, war in Afghanistan, Iraq, terrorism breaking out all over the Western world. Well, probably no generation has ever lived through untroubled times. Troubled times with their conflict, stress and blame and misery are part of the human condition. When we celebrate Anzac Day, it's hard to remain dry-eyed while we watch the dawn services and interviews with old soldiers. But in the very midst of sacrifice of the fallen, you can lose sight of the nobility and the nostalgia if you keep the telly box on too long. You'll hear the voices of those who use Anzac Day to glorify war, to exploit it, or to use it to narrowly define what it means to be an Australian. And sadly, it's often from the mouths of babes that you hear that if we didn't fight on the Turkish peninsula, we would not enjoy our current standard of living today, or our freedom. History is a cherry picker's paradise. You can find events to fit any argument or political agenda. Anzac Day reminds us of all our military involvements, but for now, World War I is a good starting point for looking at the long-term consequences of conflict. Churchill realised in 1911 that the overworked, underpaid and ill-educated coal miners of Yorkshire and Wales could hold the Royal Navy hostage by going on strike. The Royal Navy was at the time the world's largest, and it acted as the British Empire's enforcer. This is why Churchill ordered the conversion of coal-powered ships to oil. Britain's dependence on oil meant it had to control Persia's oil fields. We can infer that this was easier than controlling Yorkshiremen or the Welsh. During World War I, Britain had more than 1 million soldiers fighting Germany's Ottoman Empire allies in order to control oil supplies as well as land and sea routes to India. As colonial secretary after the war, Churchill presided over the division of the Ottoman Empire, and this was when Iraq, Syria and Saudi Arabia were created. John Maynard Keynes, the economist, said, "If you cut up the Middle East map with a pair of scissors, you'll still be fighting wars there in 100 years. Well, how prophetic was that? And while on the subject of prophecy, the last king of Egypt, King Farouk, said that by the end of the 20th century, there would only be 5 kings left: hearts, clubs, spades, diamonds, England. Well, he was wrong, wasn't he? He had a queen. But apart from that, he was also wrong, because the most powerful kings in the Middle East are those of the Saudi royal family. They've retained power because of their willingness to sell oil to the West. In fact, so much money flows into Saudi Arabia that it doesn't operate like a modern state at all. The locals employ Filipinos, Bangladeshis, Pakistanis and Indians to do the housework and the hard labour. They employ British nurses and doctors to staff hospitals. Because of the oil money, the regime doesn't need to run a bureaucracy to collect tax or to fund a comprehensive education system to supply all the engineers and doctors and lawyers needed by a modern country. So there's little chance, if the royal family were overthrown, that the population would be able to establish a democracy. They don't have the skills or the infrastructure. In addition, the Saudi royal family supports Wahhabism, that toxic form of Islam also used by ISIS to justify beheadings and stonings. Wahhabist clerics make the lives of Saudis very difficult by enforcing the repression of women and governing what citizens can say, wear, or do. Westerners sometimes joke, don't they, about how easy it is for a Muslim man to divorce. I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you. But in the 2015 Writers' Week, I heard what the practical realities of divorce were in Saudi Arabia by listening to an American detective writer who'd been married to a Saudi man. His mother had undermined the marriage and was jubilant when he married a local girl. She, of course, approved of the local girl, but for him it was a disaster. They didn't get on, and he couldn't afford a divorce. Why? Because in practice, a Saudi man is obliged to support ex-wife and kids forever, because Saudi women can't earn money, and the courts respond accordingly, ordering impossibly large settlements, which is why miserable liaisons are not uncommon there. Well, that was a bit of a lengthy digression, but we'll get back to the conflict, which I'm sure you're looking forward to, in the Middle East. The fall of the Ottoman Empire enabled European countries to install puppet governments and bolster regimes that aligned with their interests. World War I segues into World War II, into the Cold War, after which the undemocratically established regimes of the Middle East became increasingly difficult for any power to manage. But the Western will to manage continues unabated because of their continued thirst for the black stuff. This was a little cartoon that I picked up I found years ago in 2003, and I couldn't find it again, so I just drew it. I think that's copyright. I'm not sure how that works, but there you are, that's what I did. It's hard to see any merit in the phrase fighting for our freedom in relation to this sequence of events. It would be more true to assert that war creates dysfunctional states and dysfunctional political and religious movements. To see ISIS simply as a byproduct of Islam is to ignore a hell of a lot of history. At this point, I'd like to note that Wahhabism is a sect of the Sunni Islam. Iran is predominantly Shia, so when the Shiites deposed the Shah, the West supported the Sunni regime in Iraq, until Hussein could no longer be controlled. Using one branch of a religion against another is something the West should have understood was a no-go after the Reformation and the Hundred Years' War in Europe. Let's go back to where we started, Anzac Day, World War I. Home here in Australia. It was the time of a huge sectarian battle. Protestants versus Catholics. Billy Hughes wanted conscription because after Gallipoli and the news of the casualties in France, the numbers of volunteers started to drop off. He wanted to see Australia continue to pull its weight for the empire. Catholic Archbishop Mannix, by contrast, thought that Australia had pulled its weight and was sure that only evil could come from conscription. Those of you who know your history know that we voted against conscription, but the damage was done Protestants labelled Catholics as traitors. The Labour Party lost its strength and subsequently followed dead-end isolationist policies. Sectarianism was a problem for ordinary Australians. Priests urged their parishioners to enrol their children in Catholic schools they could afford. And you can imagine how poor some of those parish schools were. Marriages between Catholics and Protestants were labelled mixed marriages. There were lots of taunts, name-calling, stereotyping, job discrimination. Until the early 60s, when the winds of change seemed to blow it away. But traces remained. Tony Abbott's moniker was the Mad Monk. His cabinet was not only almost devoid of women, it was also 50% practicing Catholic. Now, 50% Catholic is not unreasonable. Australia was once the most Irish country outside Ireland. But practicing is hardly representative of our lapsed population. It was a cabinet noted for socially regressive policies. Simon Grayling, author of The Good Book, a secular Bible for modern times, would like to see more atheists in public life. Grayling is no lover of Catholicism. When the socially progressive José Luis Zapatero became Prime Minister of Spain, he aimed policies at ending direct government subsidy to churches, allowing same-sex civil unions, easing divorce laws, and encouraging greater participation and opportunities for women in Spain's society and economy. The Vatican responded by conducting the largest ever mass beatification of 498 pro-Franco victims of persecution during the Spanish Civil War. Grayling points out that Tony Blair and President Reagan came perilously close to using supernaturalistic justifications for the invasion of Iraq in 2003. If you remember Blair's pieties and the Republican rhetoric about the axis of evil, you'll see exactly what he meant. Grayling thinks atheist leaders of state will not think that they're getting messages from beyond or above to go to war. He thinks they would be less supportive of faith-based schools, neutral between religious pressure groups, and more likely to see religious movements as civil society organisations like trade unions, Boy Scouts, political parties. Every right to exist, but no more entitled to privileges, legal exemptions and tax handouts than any other self-appointed interest group. Now, I'm sure that the wholehearted embrace of secularism would not solve the conflict and strife on earth, but as Unitarians, I'm sure that we all occasionally feel misgivings when church leaders weigh in on debates on educational programs and social policy. We tend to agree with their condemnations of gambling, but generally we don't like being lumped in with Christians and suspected of holding regressive views. I guess where I'm going with all this is to suggest that we need to think through the issues and reflect on the history instead of falling back onto so-called Christian values or, equally bad, secular motherhood statements. Like, drugs are bad. Would we still be in Afghanistan, for example, if George Bush had not demanded that the Kabul government destroy the poppy crop in order to deprive the Taliban of funds? The actual result was to alienate tribespeople by depriving them of their livelihoods, and that added to the recruitment pool for the Taliban. What if the Americans instead had bought the crop for a generous amount, thereby endearing themselves to the tribesmen and depriving the Taliban of income and recruits? There are many, many issues that require thinking through the realities of people's lives instead of using one-liner value statements to justify political decisions. We should be allergic to phrases like stop the boats, mum and dad investors, zero tolerance, and suspicious of truisms like Freedom of choice is central to our values, and we must therefore take responsibility for our decisions and actions. Is it really that plain and simple when products are designed to be addictive? Or if advertising grooms children? We should also be critical of labels. Homophobe, terrorist, immigrant. We saw knee-jerk responses to all these words after the Florida nightclub massacre. The gunman's easy access to arms seems to me to be rather more real than his connection to ISIS. But do I know? Does Hillary know? Does Trump know? Does the LGBTQ community know? Or is there just far too much speculation before investigation? My plea is that we define our terms, debate the positives and negatives, and look at the impact of legislation on people's lives. We've done it before. Our response to AIDS and to the Port Arthur massacre are admired well beyond Australia. We need to assess the aptness of moral dictums in context, and we should insist that politicians and purveyors of products do the same. And above all, remember this.
And that's our episode of Expanding Horizons for the week. The introduction is a piece named Elements by the artist CDK. The piece is licensed under Creative Commons. This is White Rabbit, out.